So I apologize for giving a transparency talk, but I hurt my back yesterday and I might have to sit down. Let me start with a remark. I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I've recently written a review about this stuff to save time and leave out all references. So I'm going to talk about the work of lots of people if you want to find out who, read my review. I'd also like to make a use of a slightly different terminology than people often use. I'm going to use M-theory to refer strictly to that unknown, super-generally covariant quantum mechanical theory, or whatever generalization of super-general covariance we eventually come up with, which underlies everything. And we don't know what M-theory is. What we do know about it are some facts. It's supersymmetric. As a consequence, it has a moduli space of vacua. And in certain limiting regimes of that moduli space of vacua, we know what M-theory reduces to. And in particular, there's a regime which people often call the M-theory regime, which is the regime where it reduces to 11-dimensional supergravity on large manifolds, manifolds large compared to the 11-dimensional Planck scale. It means all the sizes of all of the features of the manifold, the typical variations of the metric, take place on scales larger than the 11-dimensional Planck scale. So that's one limiting regime of M-theory. I'm not going to call that M-theory, though many people do. That's just the 11-dimensional limit of M-theory, or the Sugra limit of M-theory. And then there are other regimes which typically have to do, from a geometrical point of view, look like they have to do with limits where certain cycles in manifolds are taken very small, in which M-theory reduces to weakly coupled string theories of various types. And we believe all string theories arise in this way. The one that I'm going to be making most extensive use of is the limit of M-theory compactified on a single circle or a single circle across a large manifold, where the radius of that circle is now taken very, very small, much smaller than the 11-dimensional Planck scale. In that limit, M-theory is supposed to reduce to weakly coupled type 2A string theory compactified on whatever M-theory was compactified on minus that circle. Okay. Now, to start...
Yes, sure. Say that this is M-theory, it's an unknown theory. But when you say theory, I presume you do mean...
By theory, I mean there's going to be a Lagrangian with a set of degrees of freedom. And that's right. I believe. Okay. I don't know what it is. I will show you in certain limiting situations what I think the Lagrangian is, at least in a particular gauge. Okay. So... the approach to M-theory, which we call matrix theory, is based on a general approach to relativistic physical theories that was begun long ago in quantum field theory called light cone physics. It really should be called light front or light plane physics, but I'm not going to try to change that piece of terminology. Basically, what one does is one takes a theory that it has at least two flat Minkowski space-time dimensions and introduces coordinates x plus and minus, which are t plus or minus x10, where x10 is the flat is a flat spatial direction, and rewrites things in those coordinates, treating one of those light plane coordinates, x plus, as a time variable, and using that as the time which defines canonical formalism and Hamiltonians. And the other one is one of the spatial variables. Now, in order to understand the peculiar features of this kind of quantization, what the simplest thing to do is look at the simplest example, which is a scalar field theory. So the Lagrangian of a scalar field theory in some, let's say, completely flat Minkowski space looks as follows in these coordinates. It's d plus phi, d minus phi, minus the transverse gradient squared, minus some non-derivative potential that gives rise to some interactions. That's a typical scalar field Lagrangian. And the queer features of this kind of quantization derive from the fact that the Lagrangian is linear in time derivatives, and that as a consequence, the canonical momentum of the field is essentially one of the spatial derivatives, the spatial derivative in this special light-like spatial direction, what I will call the longitudinal direction, B minus. And so this is a constrained system. The canonical momenta and the variables are not independent. You have to do Dirac quantization. You end up with a canonical commutation relation for the fields that says phi with phi is 1 over a half of the derivative operator D minus. To invert the derivative operator D minus, you have to say something about what the zero modes are doing. And the zero modes are clearly very important in this system, because if you look at this formula, you see that the zero modes don't have any canonical conjugates. Zero modes, I mean the things that are annihilated by the operator D minus. So they have no canonical conjugates. So they're constraint variables. They're not canonical variables. They should be eliminated from the Lagrangian, and I write down a Hamiltonian, in terms of the other variables.
Why you should do Dirac quantization rather than, path integral quantization for the zero modes, assuming if you do a different...
Path integral quantization is usually derived from Dirac quantization. That's what Ludwig Fadejev taught me in 1975, and that's the attitude I take towards it. So the main general features of this are the following. Phi zero is constrained, has to be eliminated. Now, when I make the Fourier expansion in the longitudinal direction of the field, another peculiar thing comes out. In order to realize these commutation relations, I find that the field should be written in this way, where phi n is an annihilation operator and phi n dagger is the corresponding creation operator. And notice that I sum only over n's greater than zero. So the creation operators in the theory exist only for positive values of the longitudinal momentum, the things that create negative values of longitudinal momentum are actually annihilation operators. There are no states in the theory that have negative longitudinal momentum. So in writing this formula in terms of a discrete sum over n, I've actually done something rather peculiar. I've made the first step towards introducing what's called discrete light cone quantization. What I've done is I've taken this Minkowski space, and instead of quantizing this theory on that Minkowski space, I've introduced a new space in which I identify vectors under translation by a light-like vector, r, r, where that means r, 0 means a time-like component, a component in the 10 direction, and the rest of it 0. So I pick a particular light-like direction, and I make identifications with a certain period r in that direction. This, yes.
One question about the independent moment. So, in fact, there are actually two, as far as I know, two definitions of light from quantization. One is just like you did here. So, you start with geometry where you have actually light like circles. And then you find that there is this system is singular in the sense that you have constraint, and you solve it first, and then quantize it. But then there is another way, which is to start with stage-like circle and boost it, and then obtain the light cone quantization. And it's not obvious to me that these two are equivalent.
It's not obvious to anybody that these two are equivalent.
The work of Theramon Polititsky seems to indicate that there are subtleties in the equivalent.
There are subtleties at many, many points. This whole formalism involves us in the sorts of interchanges of limits that physicists always do sloppily. And I'm going to try to point out at each place. You've got me a little bit early. I was about to point out that there are lots of subtleties. Here I'm taking the first point of view for the moment. Okay. In fact, you'll see precisely what I do throughout most of the lecture for the moment. Okay. Now, so identifying along a light-like circle is a little bit weird. If you identified along a time-like circle, you'd say you had closed time-like curves in the space and violations of causality and the grandfather paradox and all sorts of things like that. And you'd worry, and a light-like circle is almost a time-like circle. So the first question that comes up really is, does this procedure make any sense? And I'll formulate more precisely how one proposes to make sense out of it in a minute, and that'll lead us to our first question. I would like to make, however, two other remarks before I do that. First of all, as I said, the Hamiltonian in this framework is the generator of translations in X plus. It's called P minus because the metric is off diagonal in these coordinates. That can be worked out fairly easily in the classical approximation. Notice that in order to work it out, I have to solve the constraint equations for the zero modes. That's relatively easy to do in the classical approximation. But quantum mechanically, it's a hard problem. And in fact, when people do this kind of quantization perturbatively, they never solve that problem in that way. What they actually do is they start out with the naive classical Hamiltonian for the non-zero modes. They find out when they do perturbation theory with that Hamiltonian that the answers they get, which are formulated in a particular Lorentz frame, are not really Lorentz invariant. And then they realize order by order in perturbation theory that they can fix that up and make a Lorentz invariant answer by adding counter terms at each order in perturbation theory. And that's in any practical calculation in light cone perturbation theory. That's what one really has to do, add counter terms to fix up Lorentz invariants. Now, so usually the Hamiltonian is hard to work out. Usually Lorentz invariance makes it unique up to the usual renormalizations. If there's a unique set of continuum field theories in perturbation theory near this one, then Lorentz invariance is enough to reduce it to the usual. Yeah. Yes. No. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Another point that David just made that I should have made. Sometimes in certain theories, the zero modes can take arbitrary values. They're just not constrained at all. There are different vacuum states compared, given by different choice of at least some of the zero modes. And in that case, each such vacuum state gives you a different Hamiltonian. So there's the ambiguity that's usually associated in quantum field theory with degenerate vacuum states comes out here as just different Hamiltonians. Okay. Now, finally, I want to give you the definition of what's called discrete light cone quantization. Discrete light cone quantization, one does this discretization of the longitudinal momentum by identifying along the light-like circle. And then, since the longitudinal momentum is conserved and positive, I can fix a positive integer n and work in the subspace of the theory in which the total longitudinal momentum is n. When n is very large, we expect the eigenstates of the theory to be describable as scattering states of particles. And if I look at particles that have finite fractions of that total very large n, then that tells us that the p minuses that I'm looking for are of order 1 over n. And so if I was interested in the subspace with very large n, and I'll tell you why we're interested in that in a second, I'd only be interested in those eigenstates of this Hamiltonian which have energies of order 1 over n. Now, one of the attractions of discrete light cone quantization is that for small n, the theory starts to look very simple. We all know that in perturbation theory, the complication of quantum field theory comes from the fact that you have to sum over graphs, and there are lots of graphs. But in the light cone, that's not true. Graphs correspond to processes in which particles split up into other particles, conserving momentum. And if the momentum is integer valued and positive and bounded by 2, there aren't too many splitting processes that can occur. And so in that subspace with n equals 2, well, in the subspace with n equals 1, nothing can happen. So the theory is just free particles. In the subspace with n equals 2, only very simple processes can occur that go between states that have small differences in the number of particles. And so the Hamiltonian in one of these small n subspaces reduces to a Hamiltonian for a finite number of quantum mechanical particles. And it becomes fairly simple. So that's nice. Physicists like to start from someplace simple, even if they're going someplace complicated. Why do we want to go someplace complicated? The reason we want to go someplace complicated, namely to n equals infinity, is that this is the only hope of getting rid of this crazy light-like compactification. The idea is the following. One thing you should realize, I had a scale, an R, in that light-like compactification. And normally when we think about space-like compactification, we say, ah yes, I can get back the uncompactified theory from the theory compactified on radius r by rescaling r, because r is a distance, and when I take it to infinity, then I get infinite distance. But r here is a null distance. The square of the vector that I'm identifying by is zero. And in fact, if the original theory was Lorentz invariant, then R comes into the Hamiltonian in an absolutely trivial way. A Lorentz boost on the original theory just rescales the value of R. All values of R are the same. So I can't get the decompactified limit by taking R to infinity. It doesn't mean anything. So the idea is that if I take N very, very large, then by the usual theorems about Fourier transforms, if I have lots of momentum components, I can make wave packets that are very, very concentrated along that longitudinal circle, and those wave packets should behave in the way that wave packets in the uncompactified theory behave. And therefore, the large n limit of the discrete light cone quantization of some theory X is equal to X. Now, this is not an argument. This is a plausibility argument, a heuristic argument, but it's something that we, for any given theory, we really have to test, and this is, in fact, one of the hardest questions about the whole approach to matrix theory that we've taken, namely, is we're going to be using an approach to M theory in which we do discrete light cone quantization. It's not clear that the large N limit recovers a Lorentz invariant theory, which is the M theory we originally wanted to discuss. Yes?
You said large N is the only way to decompactify. I'm curious, for you, letting epsilon equal the invariant radius over the coordinate radius.
Okay.
For almost like. Is anything known about the perturbation theory in epsilon? If you can calculate those coefficients, if it's converging.
I think very little is known. I think. Well, I thought the question was being asked in a rather general way.
Sure.
Okay. Now, I want to introduce another notion, which is the notion of DLCQ that we'll really use, and that is to think of this light-like compactification as the limit of a space-like compactification. So what I do is I take a space-like vector, 0RS, and I take a Lorentz transformation, cosh omega, sinh omega, and so on, and I act on that in such a way that I get the light-like vector. Well, obviously, I can't do that unless I take RS to 0, because the invariant square is always 0 under a Lorentz transformation. So the idea is to take a space-like circle of 0 size and boost it up by an infinite amount in such a way that in the limit you get a light-like direction. And so
what do you mean by boost an infinite amount?
By this amount. e to the omega is r over rs with r going to 0. Okay? If I do such a boost on such a vector, I get that in the limit rs goes to 0. Okay. When I do that, I can relate this light cone Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian, remember, is the translation in the x plus direction. So it's the energy minus the momentum in the space-like direction, and then it's boosted up, so it's e to the omega times that. I can relate that, which is going to become the light cone Hamiltonian, to an original Hamiltonian minus a momentum in the space-like frame, and they're related by this factor e to the omega. And so if I try to do this and I want to look at finite light cone energies, I have to be looking at E minus P10s in the original space-like frame, which have very small energies, energies proportional to the radius, RS. Similarly, in order to get n units of light-like momentum here, I have to take n units of space-like momentum in the original unboosted frame. Again, in a very naive way, space-like compactification and boosting in this way, which means space-like compactification and concentration just on these energy and momentum scales, which will give rise to finite light cone energies and momenta, appears in a very naive way to converge to light-like compactification. And a question arises. We don't know the answer to this question, I think, in any theory for sure. Does this RS goes to zero limit really converge to the discrete light cone quantization? Okay. Another question, I've told you in discrete light cone quantization, to get back to the real physics I'm interested in, I have to take n goes to infinity. I'm going to think about doing that by thinking about this RS goes to zero prescription and then taking n to infinity. Do those two limits commute with each other? All very hard questions. I will not give you an answer to any of them. Yes?
On the face of it, it looks like it's going to tie very much to weakly coupled fluid string theory.
Right.
It takes a weak coupling before you do anything else. So what else can you get?
Yes.
So how can one hope to sort of go beyond the that you always insist on taking weak coupling limits before you left and get more?
Well, if you believe in commutativity of various of the limits that are being taken here, you can surmise that you will get, by this procedure, via, as we'll see in a minute, weakly coupled to a string theory, a non-perturbative definition of the discrete light cone quantized M theory, and then by taking N to infinity, the full M theory. I'm putting out front the very hard questions of whether that's true or not. I don't know whether that's true. I think the way that we've approached this is to make that hypothesis and try to build up whatever evidence that we can. Okay? And I think that there is some evidence. And my main purpose here is to tell you about it. Okay, so that was a very general discussion based on ideas from quantum field theory. I now want to start talking about string theory. The first thing I'd like to do is to talk about ideas about discrete light cone quantization in string theory. Well, I'm going to have to assume you know something about light cone string theory, and the thing I'm going to assume you have to know that in light cone string theory, the length of strings is proportional to the longitudinal momentum in the light cone frame. That's the way the light cone gauge is chosen in string theory, the way that we set it up. So what it means to do a discrete light cone quantization in string theory is to chop up the string into bits, to say that there's a smallest amount of string, that's the fundamental object in the theory, that a general string is gotten together by putting together a number of bits, that if I'm in the sector with discrete light cone momentum n, then I look only at strings that have n bits or multi-string states that are made up of strings of smaller numbers of bits that add up to n. And that's string theory. One of the reasons that we think that the large n limit is well behaved in this case, in string theory, as opposed to in a much more general context, and does give you the right answer, is that discretization of the world sheet is something that we understand very well in string theory. And we understand precisely what's involved in taking the continuum limit of a discrete world sheet in string theory. It's the renormalization group of two-dimensional quantum field theory. And so it appears that from this point of view, at least, string theory is better behaved than one might have generically thought something was under this limit. Namely, it's fairly easy to see that in string theory, you can make a discrete light quantization of perturbative string theory, write down the Hamiltonian in the light cone, a Hamiltonian in the light cone frame that reproduces the conventional string perturbation amplitudes in the continuum limit, because you know what you're doing is trying to write down the Hamiltonian that generates two-dimensional continuum conformal field theories on Riemann surfaces, and we were taught how to do that many years ago by Stanley Mandelstam. So I do have one reference. Okay. You're right. You never learn. Okay. Now, this feature that comes out of string theory, that somehow the degrees of freedom of the string in this discrete light quantization are the bits, and that, see, in quantum field theory, we have creation and annihilation operators for particles with longitudinal momentum, and we have creation and annihilation operators for fundamental particle degrees of freedom with every allowed value of the longitudinal momentum. Here we can imagine that the fundamental degrees of freedom of which the string is made up are just the bits, and the fundamental degrees of freedom then just carry one particular value of longitudinal momentum, and of course you can get any positive number of those by stringing them together. This is a principle which has been generalized and is now called the holographic principle. Now, the holographic principle was actually enunciated before string theory in a non-string theoretic context in a slightly different manner, and in a manner that I think is actually probably the right one, but reduces to this one in the case where there is a light-like killing vector in the space, so that I know what I'm talking about when I say conserved longitudinal momentum. The original holographic principle arose in the context of black hole physics in trying to understand the Bekenstein bound on the entropy, or the number of degrees of freedom, of a system which had a black hole in it, and the fact that that entropy is bounded by the area of the black hole horizon. And that doesn't seem to make sense if you think about all the degrees of freedom inside the volume of the black hole. And so the idea of the holographic principle was that space is somehow an illusion on a fundamental level, and that the fundamental degrees of freedom can be projected off to a screen someplace which sits on some light-like surface. Doesn't matter in the right theory what light-like surface it sits on, and you can formulate the system on that one light-like surface. It only has dimensions transverse to that light-like surface. And degrees of freedom per unit volume transverse to that light-like surface. So that's the holographic principle in the case where the longitudinal momentum is conserved and defines a good quantum number. We can formulate it more precisely by saying that the fundamental degrees of freedom have only the lowest value of the longitudinal momentum. That means I don't have to know about what they're doing in the longitudinal direction. I specify them on the screen, and then their wave function in the longitudinal direction is completely known. Things that are localized in the longitudinal direction arise as composites of these more fundamental degrees of freedom. Okay. So that's discrete light cone quantization in a nutshell in string theory. Now what about M theory? Well, yes.
As a mathematician, this is a critical issue, what you just described, of getting to matrix models. I don't understand. You see, let's assume I understand conformal field theory, the usual strings, the moving strings, Riemann surfaces, and all that. I don't know what you mean about taking a string and breaking it up into bits and being able to compare whatever theory you're talking about when you break that string up into bits.
So
a theory I think I know.
Take a theory that instead of strings consists of little little pieces of interval,
yeah.
And there are things that create pieces of interval, okay? And they have you can write down a Hamiltonian for such pieces of interval, which has the property that, first of all, in some formal classical sense, it converges to the usual stringy Hamiltonian in the limit where you take the number of pieces to infinity and the size of each piece to zero. And second of all, argue by virtue of what we know about conformal field theory that that's actually a valid quantum mechanical limit of the system. So it's just the fact that I can take a conformal field theory and sort of discretize it on a lattice and then recover the continuum theory by the usual renormalization group arguments as a continuum limit of the lattice theory. It's a little more involved than that because you also have to do string interactions which involve, you know, these things that map one conformal field theory onto two and show you can get Riemann surfaces. But that actually works in string perturbation.
Where can I find that?
Work of Charles Thorne.
Okay.
It's in my review. Okay. Now I want to turn to M theory. And the reason that I've emphasized this limit of space-like compactification way of thinking about DLCQ is that this also looks a lot simpler in M theory than it might have in any other theory. For example, when people do this kind of approach to DLCQ for QCD, they're always criticized because people say, well, you're getting 3+1-dimensional QCD. That's a complicated theory in the limit. We don't know how to solve it. But the spatial circle goes to zero limit of M theory is something we understand really well. It's weakly coupled type 2A string theory. And we're taking the limit, so it's really zero coupling type 2A string theory. And so what's left? Well, the key point is that we're supposed to take states that have N units of longitudinal momentum. Now, we learned that N units of longitudinal momentum in M theory, interpreted from the point of view of weakly coupled type 2A string theory, means N D0 brains. And only positive longitudinal momenta means only D0 brains, not anti-D0 brains. And therefore, we know how to write down the Hamiltonian of that system in weakly coupled type 2A string theory in various situations for what's going on with the rest of the space that the string theory is living in. We can write down the Hamiltonian, and we can investigate its properties. And in this case, because of the fact that G string is going to zero, and actually, I think it may be a little more subtle, and we're helped by the fact that there is a lot of Susie around in most of the compactifications I'm going to talk about. I think that it's fairly easy to argue that this hard part of the Hamiltonian in discrete light cone quantization is, in this case, zero. Namely, that the Hamiltonian that we write down for the D0 brains on the basis of weakly coupled type 2A string theory is really the full Hamiltonian. Yeah. No, it's not the weakly coupled string because it's only a subset of the states of the weakly coupled string. It's a subset of the states of the weakly coupled string that survive, that have this finite energy property, in which I talked about before. I'll tell you what that means in a minute. In the GS goes to zero limit. And that subset of states is interacting even in the GS goes to zero limit, because from the point of view of string perturbation theory, they're soliton states. And so I get an interacting Hamiltonian for a subset of the degrees of freedom of weakly coupled type 2A string theory in this limit, which is certainly not weakly coupled type 2A string theory, and has certain properties that indicate that it might indeed be M theory in the appropriate limits. So what about this finite energy condition? Remember I told you that from this space-like point of view, what I had to look at were small energies that went to zero, like the radius that I was shrinking. If you go through the description of B0 brains in weakly coupled type 2A string theory, you know that the mass of the D0 brains is 1 over the space-like radius that's shrinking to zero. And so if I have n D0 brains, I have a very large energy, but that's just proportional to the total momentum in the 10th direction. And remember, I'm supposed to subtract that off to get E minus P10. And then what's left is a very small kinetic energy, P transverse squared over the mass, and that scales precisely like the radius of the dimension that I'm shrinking to zero. So the energy scale that I want to concentrate on in this limit is the energy scale of the kinetic energies of D0 brains. Everything which is getting very, very small in this limit, the kinetic energies of D0 brains with, of course, momenta. You don't know what the value of the kinetic energy is until you tell me what the momentum is, but I've used descriptions of how things work that are appropriate to using the 11-dimensional Planck scale as the fundamental scale. And so these are the orders of magnitudes of the kinetic energies of D0 brains with transverse momenta of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale. Similarly, if I consider some of the transverse dimensions to be compactified, this is the natural scaling when the compactified dimensions are of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale. Okay. So we concentrate then on this particular set of degrees of freedom of type 2A string theory in the weak coupling limit, and supposedly we get M theory. Now, one question that arises, there's a particular case here where all the transverse dimensions are non-compact, where this theory is supposed to describe 11 dimensions. And in particular, we know that real M theory in 11 non-compact dimensions at low energies is supposed to reduce to 11-dimensional supergravity. So a third question that we can ask is, does that commute with the large N limit? Namely, said another way around, if I keep N finite and go to very low energy, should I still expect that equivalence between the two theories? And finally, I've gotten to a question that I can give you a precise answer to. The answer is an unequivocal no. As a consequence, A, of many calculations, and I'll show you at the end a rather dramatic example of this inequivalence, which doesn't depend on any calculation except the calculation of the masses of BPS states. So we should be very careful about interchanging limits. You cannot do this stuff by taking one thing finite and the other thing to infinity first, or the other way around. So the zero energy limit doesn't commute with the large N limit, if the large N limit does in fact give M theory. And I actually never thought there was any reason to expect that to be true. The derivation of the fact that 11-dimensional supergravity is the low energy limit depends crucially on the full 11-dimensional Lorentz group. If you don't have it, there's no derivation. And furthermore, in this procedure of getting discrete light cone quantization of M theory, it's clear that there's some very, very short length scale involved, this short space-like length scale. And there's no reason to expect supergravity to be a good description of what goes on at that length scale. So, I think we have just a lot of independent evidence by now. The reason we were fooled for some time was that certain amplitudes do come out right for finite n, and that, I think, is a consequence of non-renormalization theorems in these very, very supersymmetric situations that we were talking about. Okay, let me quickly... I don't know. I claim is something that you prove. All right. Given a very well-defined mathematical problem, which Sethi and Stern and Parati have partially solved, you have a proof of the existence of scattering states and asymptotic completeness. All of the arguments are consequences of supersymmetry and deep mathematical theorems of that supersymmetric quantum mechanics. That's what protects it. I don't have, except for saying supersymmetry, I don't have a two-word explanation. Okay. But it's all clearly, basically a consequence of supersymmetry plus the existence of the threshold measure. No. I'll show you an example where it's clear you get wrong states in the theory at finite n, which better go away at large n if the theory is to survive. Let me get to that. Okay. So let me just very quickly run through, because I told you there was lots of evidence. I'm not going to be able to do the details of any of this, to tell you the successes of this. So in particular, one of the things that I like most about this is that the problem gets reduced to a real Hamiltonian problem, which often is a quantum field theory and may be hard to solve, but in principle we have a very precise problem to solve to answer whether various things are true or not, and some analysis of those problems has been done. And there are a number of successes. For example, you can establish in the large N limit the existence of the multigraviton spectrum and the asymptotic states that we expect to have in 11-dimensional supergravity. And there's one scattering amplitude in a very special kinematic regime, which is finite and non-zero. In other words, the scattering matrix is not one in the large N limit. And that tells us, actually, I think, quite a bit about what could possibly be happening in the large N limit. I think it reduces the question of what's happening to whether or not the theory becomes Lorentz invariant. But I don't have time to make that argument. Yeah, but you see, what I'm saying is we don't expect amplitudes to be finite, to be equal for finite N. There's one amplitude that happens to be equal for finite n. That amplitude is equal because of a special theorem, a non-renormalization theorem. That amplitude can be extrapolated to large n and gives the right Lorentz invariant answer. So that's a non-trivial result. The v to the fourth over r to the seventh interaction. I think it's a test of matrix theory. I think it says that this amplitude has the correct value that it's supposed to have. No. The degrees of freedom are eliminated by the limit that I'm taking. There's a question of whether they could have changed this Hamiltonian. But if you buy that argument, the Hamiltonian is this Hamiltonian, and we can compute. It's a little hard to discuss this question because I don't think you can write down another supersymmetric Hamiltonian with these degrees of freedom. But So I don't know what the alternative is. So you might say it's just a consequence of supersymmetry. I think that's the same as saying that this Hamiltonian is the hope to get a large N limit, which is Lorentz invariant and gives us M theory, and that it's the only hope in the 11-dimensional case. Okay, so a couple of other successes. We established the existence of membrane states in the theory, and by now there have been lots of low-energy amplitudes calculated for membranes. There's a question of whether these can all sort of be attributed to that same non-renormalization theorem and don't correspond to really further tests of the theory. And I'm not sure about that, but I think that might be true. There's a description of five brains longitudinally wrapped, one coordinate of the five brain wrapped around the longitudinal direction, weakly coupled 2A and 2B strings on arbitrary tori. Notice arbitrary, even though, as I'll be telling you in a little while, we don't have the full theory on arbitrary tori. In the weakly coupled 2A and 2B limits, we can argue that the theory will give rise to the right things. When type 2B string theory is thought of as coming out of M theory by a shrinking a 2 torus in M theory and identifying the winding number of membranes on that 2 torus with a momentum, there's a big mystery, which is why is that momentum in the limit rotational, when it becomes continuous, why is it rotationally invariant with the other momenta which originated as conjugates to spatial coordinates? You can prove using the mathematical machinery of matrix theory for any coupling that that limit is SO8 invariant. And I don't know any other argument for that fact. The weakly coupled heterotic string theories of both types come out in 10 dimensions. And M theory on K3 or TD with D less than or equal to 4 claim, there's evidence that those theories are completely described by the dynamics of a certain quantum field theory. Now the quantum field theory depends on what the compactification is. The dynamics of the quantum field theory doesn't take place in space-time. The relation between the quantum field theory and space-time is a generalization of that in string theory. The quantum field theory has a world volume, and then its target space is the transverse space-time. Only the time coordinates of the two are identified, as usual in light conjugate. For the D equals 4 cases, K3 or T4, we actually have to use a quantum field theory that we don't really know yet, the so-called 2-0 superconformal quantum field theory that arises from putting together N5 brains in M theory. There's a lot of evidence that that theory exists, but we don't really know how to write it down. We maybe know how to write it down using a generalization of these same matrix techniques, and that's an active area of study. Finally, there's been constructed in this context a crude model in certain compactification dimensions of Schwarzschild black holes, and certain of the properties of black holes have been derived from that model. This is different from the D-brain model. It's much cruder, gives much less precise results, but has the following advantage. In the D-brain model of black holes, what you do is you take a theory with a parameter, and you go to a region in parameter space where all the dynamics that you're doing takes place on length scales much, much larger than the size of the black hole. So the black hole looks like a point-like object. In that regime, you can describe many things in this extrapolated theory by weak coupling string theory with D-brains, then one uses arguments of supersymmetry to argue that these particular properties you've calculated don't change as you change the parameter, and so you've calculated something real about the black hole. This black hole model, crude as it is, purports to write down the wave function of the black hole in the real region of parameters where it looks like a big fat black hole. And so to the extent that it's been successful, or to the extent, I think more importantly, that it is successful in the future, we'll actually learn things about black holes that don't depend on supersymmetry. Now, there are a couple of generic properties that come out of the matrix description of these systems, sort of universally in all these different compactifications, that I think may have a wider range of validity than matrix theory as it's formulated today. I want to make sure you understand, I don't think we have the formulation of the theory that's the correct one yet. We're working up, and we have a very crude formulation, and but I think we've discovered certain properties in that formulation that may be generic. The first is this very interesting relation between matrices and statistics, and more generally between matrices and coordinates. So what we find generally is that the way space-time arises in these theories is we have some quantum mechanical theory whose degrees of freedom are lots of matrices. And some of those matrices end up representing the coordinates of particles moving about in the transverse dimensions of space-time in the following way. One restricts attention to the moduli space of commuting matrices, and then uses the fact that that moduli space is a Euclidean space modded out by the symmetric group. And that is the same space that you get as the configuration space of n particles with statistics. Those are Fermi statistics, and the Boson-Fermi stuff comes out right because we've done all our things supersymmetrically. So there's always been in various kinds of math physics applications, we've always had treatments of matrix problems where we introduce effective theories of particles that are bosons or fermions to describe the matrix system. The suggestion here is that that's a deeper property of the real world and not just a mathematical artifact, that really that's where particles come from in some way, that they come from studying the configuration space of multiparticle states has something to do with a moduli space of commuting elements of an algebra. Okay. The second thing closely related to this is the connection between supersymmetry and cluster decomposition. The identification of these configurations as particle states comes about at the classical level in these theories because these are flat directions of the classical potential on the space, and when I go out in those flat directions, the Lagrangian reduces to the Lagrangian for a bunch of particles described by the eigenvalues. That would not survive in a typical quantum mechanical theory. In Sethi's talk the other day, he described to us how in a typical quantum mechanical theory, when I have a system with a flat direction and its potential that gets steeper and steeper as I go out, I generate a quantum mechanical effective potential that confines me and doesn't let me run down that flat direction. And that's canceled exactly by supersymmetry. And so the fact that I have asymptotically separated particles and cluster decomposition is a consequence of at least some sort of asymptotic supersymmetry of the spectrum, asymptotic in these limits when things get very, very far apart. This is very closely related to the cancellation of tachyons in perturbative string theory, which is also a violation of the cluster property. Tachyons give spatial correlation functions that grow exponentially, and we need a certain amount of supersymmetry in order to cancel to eliminate the tachyon states from string theory. Another feature is that when you look at the deviations around these commuting matrices in the large N limit, you tend to find that it's matrices with very small commutators, commutators that go like 1 over N or something like that, that dominate the dynamics. And so there's some suggestion that while at finite N these theories are matrices, there might be some more efficient description at very large N in which I only take into account a set of matrices that are in some sense almost commuting. I will give you a guess about what that might mean at the end. It comes out of the dynamics that there exist states like that. By the arguments that I've given you, those are the only states that I can hope will go to the will look like the states of the decompactified theory, the real theory that I'm interested in. So I should be looking only at that subset of the subspace of the Hilbert space with energies of order 1 over n. And I'm claiming that there might be a more efficient description of that subspace than by a theory of all n by n matrices. Okay. Finally, a curious property, very non-intuitive from the point of view of quantum field theory. When I compactify a quantum field theory on a compact space and look at what happens to the density of states at fixed energy as I change the volume of the space, typically most of the degrees of freedom in a quantum field theory are local. And so as I make the volume of the space bigger, I get more low momentum modes and therefore more states below a finite energy. There are a few states in gauge theories and gravity that are associated with non-trivial cycles, Wilson lines and so on, but most of the states are local and are described by momentum modes. In these theories, it looks very much like, well, it's just a theorem, that as you increase the volume of the compactified space, the number of states at fixed energy goes down. Most of the degrees of freedom are associated with non-trivial cycles on the manifold, and most of them start to go away as you make the size of the, quote, universe large. This suggests to me that there might be a clue here to why the cosmological constant is so small, namely that these theories have a much smaller set of low energy degrees of freedom in a large universe than you would have imagined a local field theory in such a universe had. And the reason low energy is important is if you believe there's a finite supersymmetry breaking scale, the only degrees of freedom that contribute to the cosmological constant are those which are below the supersymmetry breaking scale, and so that might give a natural way as the universe expands to find that the total vacuum energy is very small. Okay. So, now I'd like to end up by talking about the compactification of matrix theory on Torii with dimension between 3 and 6. And then I'll talk briefly about higher than 6. The basic idea, the idea that works exactly for all D less than or equal to 3, is that you look at type 2A string theory in the weak coupling limit, you look at the degrees of freedom that have energies of the same order of magnitude as the kinetic energies of zero brains when the distances between the zero brains are of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale and the sizes of the compact manifold are of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale. For D less than or equal to 3, that's completely described by, on a torus, by supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, with a Yang-Mills coupling constant which is related to the 2A string theory by the following set of transformations. The way these Yang-Mills degrees of freedom arise, the momentum eigenstates on the torus of the Yang-Mills theory, the Yang-Mills torus is not the torus in space-time, it's dual to the torus in space-time, and the momentum eigenstates of the Yang-Mills theory have to do with the winding numbers of type 2A strings in the original string theory. One, in order to write that down in the most efficient way, one does a T-duality transformation on the original type 2A string theory. The reason you're doing that is because you want a torus which is the Planck size, namely much smaller than the type 2A string scale, and we know that in that limit, string theory is best described by doing T-duality. When one does that, one finds that the zero brains and all the winding strings connecting them are described by this Yang-Mills Lagrangian. The phi fields, the scalars, this is the maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, and the phi scalars in the Yang-Mills multiplet are proportional to the transverse coordinates of the zero brains. More precisely, if I go out on one of these flat directions where the only degrees of freedom that are left are the zero brain coordinates, the phis are the zero mode on the torus of the phi fields are the zero brain coordinates. The Wilson loops of the gauge field have to do with zero brain coordinates in the compact directions, and so on. The important thing for this discussion are the scalings. So there's a parameter G super Yang Mills. It's related to a string coupling constant in the T-dual string theory by the usual relationship. It was so tempting to say who derived that. I'm sorry. By the usual relationship to the T-dual, I'm using big letters for the T-dual string coupling constant, capital GS. Small GS is the original string coupling constant in the zero brain frame. The Yang-Mills torus is the T-dual torus, which is related to the original torus. These L's are the lengths. I'm taking them all the same. Those are the lengths which are expected to be of order Planck units on the original D0 brain side. These are the Yang-Mills torus sizes. And this is the relationship between capital GS and little GS. It's convenient to re-express these lengths L in terms of their natural scale, namely the Planck scale. And then you see that capital GS is little GS to the 1 minus D over 3 times L Planck over L to the D. Remember what we're doing. We're trying to take GS to 0 with a certain energy scale fixed. The energy scale that we're keeping fixed is, in fact, precisely the energy scale which is 1 over the length associated with this super Yang-Mills coupling constant. The reason that I can say that with such confidence is that one of the degrees of freedom in this Lagrangian is, as I told you, the coordinates of the zero brain. So this Lagrangian contains the kinetic energy of the zero brains, and that's what's supposed to remain finite. Keeping the momentum of the zero brains in the original theory of order Planck size corresponds to keeping these scalar phi fields, which are fields which have dimension of mass as the superpartners of Yang-Mills fields. They are of a scale of order this super Yang-Mills coupling constant scale. So this is the Lagrangian that describes, at least partially, the energy scale that I was interested in if I keep G super Yang-Mills fixed. So I'm supposed to take little g string to 0 with G super Yang-Mills fixed, and then you see the new thing that happens when D gets bigger than 3 is that the T-dual string coupling becomes big. Okay. Another thing that happens that one might have been disturbed about and was disturbed about before the correct way to interpret this was discovered is that the Yang-Mills theory no longer makes any sense. For D less than or equal to 3, the Yang-Mills theory is renormalizable, and we know how to define it. For D greater than 3, it's not. The reason that it's not is that this is not the full set of degrees of freedom of the theory in this limit in the case D is greater than 3. There are other degrees of freedom that have to do with brains of higher dimension, 4 brains and 6 brains, wrapped around the dimensions of this very small torus. If I wrap a high dimension brain around a very small torus, I get a very low energy state. And those are the states that are needed to make up for the non-renormalizability of the Yang-Mills theory. Now, the most efficient way, however, to figure out what's going on is just to take the clue that's given here, namely what we're supposed to be doing is describing the same set of brains by doing T-duality. I've changed the zero brains into little d brains, where d is the dimension, capital D, little d brains, where little d is the dimension of the torus. And what I'm supposed to be doing in these theories is describing the theory of those d brains in the T-dual string theory, which now has coupling going to infinity. So I shouldn't be using this Lagrangian, which is the weakly coupled Lagrangian which is a valid Lagrangian when capital G string is very small, I should be using the appropriate set of degrees of freedom and Lagrangian for the strongly coupled string theory. The strongly coupled string theory is either type 2A or type 2B, depending on whether my torus was even or odd dimension, because I'm doing an even or odd number of two dualities. So in the 4 and 6 torus cases, I'm getting a strongly coupled type 2A theory. That's the 11-dimensional supergravity limit. And in the 5-dimensional case, I'm getting strongly coupled type 2B theory, but now I can do S-duality and turn that into weakly coupled type 2B theory and see what I'm getting. So that's the trick in which you figure, by which you figure out what the physics is. Now, what actually comes out, let me save this transparency because I'll probably have to show you the scalings again. Yes? No. The original torus is very small because I wanted it to be I'm trying to describe M theory, and I want the torus to be of the 11-dimensional Planck scale. Okay? I want to think about things that are finite in M theory units. Okay? This is a transverse dimension. It doesn't Lorentz contract. That dimension is fixed to be Planck scale, that's not very small in Planck units, but it is very small in type 2A string units, and I'm using the mathematics of type 2A string theory to do this transformation. So what happens in D equals 4? In D equals 4, the zero brains become 4 brains. Those are D4 brains in type 2A string theory, but now I'm taking the coupling to infinity, and so I find that I'm going back to the 11-dimensional limit. I should be thinking about a new version of M theory, a new 11-dimensional limit of M theory with a new 11-dimensional Planck scale. It's not the same 11-dimensional Planck scale. And in that limit, a 4 brain, a D4 brain in type 2A string theory becomes a 5 brain of M theory. And we have these 4 brains very, very close together because the original 11-dimensional Planck scale is much smaller than the natural scale of this new M theory. And so we're describing 5 brains very, very close together in M theory, and that is the 2-0 superconformal field theory, the one with the little index n that's associated with the SUN group, namely the one which it lives on a 5 torus. This extra torus dimension is the new dimension that's growing because I'm taking the 2A string coupling constant large. And this has nothing to do with the dimension of space-time. This is a dimension on the world volume of these brains. And that extra dimension, if I take the 2-0 field theory and compactify it on that extra circular dimension, its low energy limit at scales below the inverse radius of that extra dimension is in fact Super-Yang-Mills theory with the Super-Yang-Mills coupling given in terms of the scale of that radius. Because of the fact that the theory is superconformal invariant, I can forget about the fact that I'm really going to the G-string goes to infinity limit. And the G-string goes to infinity limit, I'm taking that circle very, very big, okay? But in the G-string goes to infinity limit, the theory becomes superconformal invariant, so I can rescale the volume and take the in such a way that that circle defines my unit of length. And then I compare everything else to that. So this theory, which we know exists but we don't know the full dynamics of, is a quantum field theory on a 5 torus, and that is what defines the 4 toroidal description of M theory in discrete light cone quantization. You can do something very similar for the case of K3, and you get the same superconformal field theory just on a T-dual K3 to the K3 that M theory spacetime lives in. Okay. Now let's do D equals 5. So I told you how we're going to do D equals 5. We do the T-duality. We get strongly coupled type 2B string theory. We're studying D5 brains in strongly coupled type 2B string theory. Now I do S-duality to go back to a weakly coupled type 2B string theory. When I do S-duality, the D5 brains become NS5 brains. And so I end up with the theory of N Navier-Schwartz 5 brains in weakly coupled type 2B string theory, where the new type 2B string coupling, GS tilde, is going to zero. It's very important to understand what the new type 2B string length is. I've done S-duality, so my weakly coupled type 2B strings were originally the D strings, and the string tension is the original D string tension. So I have to rewrite what that is in terms of L super Yang Mills, and as you can see from this formula, everything cancels out, and it's just L super Yang Mills. So the scale that appears in the theory is the scale of this type 2B string theory, the weakly coupled one. We're taking the coupling of that type 2B string theory to zero, and in that limit, we're studying objects that are very strange from the point of view of the weakly coupled theory. As you may know, Navier-Schwartz 5 brains in weakly coupled string theory are described by classical field equations. And the classical, very schematically, the classical field configuration for a bunch of 5 brains looks as follows. You have the bunch of 5 brains sitting next to each other. I'll tell you in a minute that the distance between the 5 brains in this scaling turns out to be much, much smaller than the type 2B string length. If you run through the scalings and ask what the original 11-dimensional Planck length was, it's much, much smaller than the type 2B string length. So you have type 2B NS5 brains all sitting on top of each other from the point of view of the type 2B length scale, and that's described at large distances by a classical solution of the low energy field equation. And that classical solution has the property that even though the coupling is weak out at infinity, and we're in fact taking a limit where the coupling at infinity goes to zero, the dilaton increases and goes to infinity by the time you hit the 5 brains, no matter how small it was to begin with. The way that happens is by this tube separating the asymptotic region from the place where the 5 brains sit becoming infinitely large. So the 5 brains are non-trivially interacting things, and we don't know what their Lagrangian is, but we do have a definition of what the theory is. Now, yeah. I'm not hearing exactly what you're saying.
If you had a longitudinal compact direction, then you could map this to a 2A and 5A. And then the divergence will have a clear measure of that. If you're going back to the one event,
all that I'm saying, all that I meant to say was that we don't, from this description, we know that we're getting what looks like it should be a sensible limit of string theory, but we don't know how to write down what that limit is. That's all I meant by saying that it was mysterious. I can't write a Lagrangian with coordinates and momenta and interactions, as I was more or less able to do in all the previous cases, the 2-0 case being a slight exception. But there's a more serious problem here, and that's the one that I want to concentrate on. When one studies these 5 brains, if one has 5 brains that are a little bit excited, then the configuration of fields outside of the 5 brains looks like a near-extremal black hole. And as a consequence, you can calculate in a fairly reliable way that there is emission of stuff into the bulk of this type 2B string theory. Notice in all previous cases, that didn't occur. In all previous cases, when I took this limit in which the limit that I was taking to get the discrete light cone quantization, all of the states except the ones that lived on these brains completely decoupled from the states that live on the brains. There's no emission of things into the bulk from the brains. Everything, by bulk I mean the dimensions, I mean the degrees of freedom in the string theory that propagate transverse to the brains. I just mean the two. Yeah. I don't really think that distinction is too important, but we can discuss that later. The rate of emission can be calculated. It's a Hawking evaporation calculation in semi-classical gravity. It's finite. The states that are emitted remain at finite energy. Remember, we're supposed to be keeping the 2B string length fixed, and those states are up there right at the 2B string length. So these states are there at finite energy. The emission into those states is a finite number, the emission probability. It's a number that is of order 1 over n. So maybe it goes away in the large n limit. But now I want to emphasize the most, to my mind, the most important and serious property that these states have, which is the following. I told you that the 11-dimensional Planck length, which I started with, is much smaller than the 2B string length, right, when you go through these scalings. In the previous cases where all of the ordinary 2B excitations completely decoupled from the brains, that had no particular effect on what was going on because the only things that carried transverse momentum were the brains themselves. And so the order of magnitude of the transverse momentum of every state in the theory was of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale, and it didn't matter that it was going to zero, going to infinity relative to the energy scale because I could rescale energy and time, energy and distance independently. And so I could study the regime with Planck momenta and this energy scale, and that was the right regime for D0 brains. But in this system, the degrees of freedom that are propagating off the brain into this tube are ordinary 2B string states. And those ordinary 2B string states typically carry transverse momenta of order the 2B string length. So how am I supposed to interpret those states from the point of view of M theory? Well, if this 2B string length is much larger than the 11-dimensional Planck scale, then a momentum of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale is much larger than the momenta of these particles, and that difference is becoming infinite in the limit that I'm taking. And so these states are states which have zero transverse momentum from the point of view of M theory. In other words, the conserved quantum number that represents the transverse momentum in M theory is just the part of the total transverse momentum of this 2B system that's becoming infinite in 2B string units that's of order the 11-dimensional Planck scale. That, of course, is independently conserved. The string modes that are still coupled into the system carry infinitesimal amounts of that momentum, and in the limit they carry zero units of this Planck scale momentum. So they should be interpreted in M theory as states that have zero transverse momentum. They also have, because they don't have zero brain number, zero longitudinal momentum in M theory. And so they have a dispersion relation. P minus is of order L super Yang Mills to the minus 1, namely a finite P minus, but they have exactly zero P plus and P transverse. That's not a dispersion relation that's compatible with 11-dimensional Lorentz invariance. Therefore, these states, if they persisted in the large N limit, would violate 11-dimensional Lorentz invariance, and it's very good that we have a coupling that a computation that suggests that they decouple in the large N limit. Okay. Now, when these theories were first described, it was thought that these states decoupled. It was thought that they defined a new kind of Lorentz invariant non-gravitational string theory that lived only on these five brains, and they were called non-critical string theories. We see now that they actually do interact with the string degrees of freedom in the bulk. I think they should more properly be called something like Kondo string theories. The Kondo model is a model in field theory in which I have free fields coupled to some small quantum mechanical degrees of freedom at a single point. And then the free fields are free, but then they interact with these quantum mechanical degrees of freedom. And those are actually quite complicated systems which have much of the complication of field theory. I think that these things might be simpler than the full string theory, but they are not as simple as the limits that we've gotten previously. They really do have the degrees of freedom of string theory in them, most free in bulk, but interacting strongly with some defects in the system. Excuse me? Okay. The large N limit comes in that I hope that, and by this calculation, I believe, that these states decouple as N goes to infinity. I think if they don't, we know that the theory is not Lorentz invariant in the large N limit. Okay. It's supposed to be better for a large N. Okay, let's discuss it.
My understanding is the second part characteristically by saying that, of course, N is like the charge on the five ring, and I'm fixing the amount of energy above externality, and if I increase,
the Hawking radiation, the size of the geometry gets bigger, and the.
Close to externality, right. The ratio of the excess energy is fixed to the total mass, which is N.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the argument. Okay. Let me try to finish my discussion before I know some of this is I'm sure controversial. Let me try to finish up talking about the rest of the dimensions, and then we can discuss to our heart's content. So the D equals 6 system I can go through very briefly now because it's very similar. There's one crucial difference. Again, we're now in type 2A string theory at strong coupling. I'm going to the M theory limit. Now what I'm supposed to be studying is a bunch of D6 brains that are very close together compared to the new 11-dimensional Planck scale that's arising in this limit. The calculation shows that the new 11-dimensional Planck scale, capital L Planck, is the same as this super Yang-Mills scale and is much bigger than the L Planck of the original M theory. As a consequence, what I get in this limit, well, it's M theory. I'm going to 11 dimensions. What do I get? I get supergravity. L Planck is finite, so the supergravity is a fully coupled supergravity theory. And the states I'm really interested in are these ND6 brains, which become in this limit first, N Kaluza-Klein monopoles in compactified supergravity, and then in the limit that G really goes to infinity and I decompactify this dimension, they become ALE singularities of type N. The real dynamics I'm interested in is the motions of the collective coordinates of those ALE singularities over distances that are infinitesimal compared to the Planck scale. Again, what happens is that if I look at it from the point of view of the 2A string theory before the limit, if I look in the transverse dimensions, these brains carry much more transverse momentum, infinitely more in the limit, than the things I'm calling gravitons. The brains don't decouple from the gravitons, but because they carry infinitely more transverse momentum, the gravitons become states with P longitudinal equals P transverse equals zero in M theory, and they violate Lorentz invariance. The crucial difference of this case as compared to the D equals 5 case is that previously the spectrum of these funny states that one hoped went away in the large N limit started up at a finite place. Now these are gravitons. Their dispersion relation goes all the way down to zero, and they are there at arbitrarily low P minus. And so this is the most, and the argument that this occurs is essentially a BPS argument. You're really just calculating the masses of BPS states plus, well, I guess we are also claiming that the coupling remains finite. And the argument shows in a very, very dramatic way that at arbitrarily low energies, discrete light cone quantized M theory is not the same as discrete light cone supergravity. It has other states that violate Lorentz invariance from the 11-dimensional point of view, and they're there at arbitrarily low energies, and they have to go away for some other reason. And there's, at best, a hand-waving argument why they go away, and if I say it, Eva will kill me, so I won't even try to indicate to you why they might go away, because I think we don't really have a good argument for it. Okay. So we've now established the picture. I think there are two conclusions one could make about this picture on D equals 5 and D equals 6. The conclusion is either that we have this complicated system of which we have to take the large n limit to have any hope of getting the right physics, or that we don't get the right physics by discrete light cone quantization, period. Namely, these states continue to couple even in the large n limit. What happens when I go to D equals 7 is in some sense even worse, but it's bad for a reason that I feel is much better understood, and I don't understand the connection between what I'm about to say and what I said a moment ago. In D equals 7, you're taking an 11-dimensional theory. You light-like compactified a circle, which we exchanged for a space-like compactification, and now we're compactifying 7 more dimensions. So I have a non-compact space with 2 plus 1 space-time dimensions. If you take gravity in any number of dimensions greater than 3 and compactify it to 2 plus 1 space-time dimensions, you get a scalar field representing the sizes of the compactified dimensions in the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, which is a massless scalar field. Furthermore, if you take any state that has non-zero momentum around the compactified dimension, it's a source for that scalar field. And its scalar field strength out at infinity goes to, depending on how you define it, zero or infinity, in such a way that the energy of the state with non-zero longitudinal momentum is infinite. That's a very simple calculation in compactified gravity. In a normal quantum theory, you might mumble about that going away, but in string theory with supersymmetry, that's actually a BPS formula, so it's an exact calculation. So every degree of freedom that you try to introduce into discrete light cone quantized M theory, if you compactify too much, has infinite energy. I think the reason for that is as I've stated it to you, it's a property of gravity. If you compactify a theory with gravity too much, you can't put matter into the theory anymore and still keep the space-time static. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to find static vacuum states. If you compactify gravity too much and you try to look at states with matter, there are solutions of gravity which are static, but if you perturb them, if they're have low enough non-compact space dimension left over, and you perturb them with a little matter, it does big things because gravity is long range in low dimensions. And really what you always find is that the nice finite solutions of the equations of motion are not static, they're cosmologies with matter and gravitation interacting with each other in a time-dependent way. So I think this problem for D equals 7 and above is an indication of something deeper, more general. It's an indication that we really, in thinking about M theory, are going to have to face the fact, finally, that the concept of a static vacuum state is only an approximate one, that the real theory will live in a cosmological space-time, and we're going to have to learn how to do without all of these nice killing vectors and formulate our principles in a way that's independent of them. So I think that the two big questions that are raised by this approach to M theory are the following. Number one, what precisely is the holographic principle and what replaces discrete light cone quantization? in a cosmological space-time that doesn't have any null-killing vectors? How do we set up the problem? How do we formulate what we've tried to do for those cases which do have static vacuum states in a way that doesn't require us to assume these things that don't make any sense in low enough dimensions? Big question number two is that we've seen that to get the physics right, it's absolutely crucial to take the large N limit. It seems to me very clear from what's been done that the current setup has many more degrees of freedom in it than we really need for large N. What's the correct effective theory of large N for these kinds of large N theories? This is very different from conventional Tuftian large N physics. These energy scales of order 1 over N don't exist unless you have supersymmetry, and the effective theory for those energy scales is something that, except in certain limits like the matrix string limit, we really don't have a way of grasping. That, I think, is a key problem, one that, if this approach is going to be successful, is going to occupy us for a long time. Finally, of course, is big question zero, which is M is for what? It's obviously not for matrix. We should find out what it is. It's the same thing. It's the logarithmic divergence of the scalar field around D7 brains.
So you said
that okay, that's how does that relate? How does that show that you have energy? Because the D7 brain tension, the thing that plays the role of the D0 brain mass here, would be the value of that scalar field at infinity. It's 1 over g at infinity, and g is going to 0 logarithmically at infinity. G like a power, and the dilaton is going to infinity logarithmically at infinity, so g goes to 0 like a power at infinity. And the BPS formula says that the tension is proportional to 1 over g, so it's infinite. Yes. Well, another way to say the same thing is if you take the theory of gravity compactified in this way and try to calculate an ADM energy for this state from classical gravity, you get the same answer, and it's infinite. Okay, so I think that is a valid conclusion. And as I say, I think the real physics of it is not so puzzling. We've known for a long time that once you compactify gravity, if you want to put matter in, you have to start talking about cosmology. The queer thing here is that because of the discrete light cone quantization, this extra circle you've compactified, it happens one dimension before you would have normally expected it to happen, because you've compactified this extra circle with the intention of later taking that compactification away, but of course the theory with that circle compactified is now dramatically different because of this infrared divergence. Again, I think the right way to deal with this problem is to formulate the theory in a cosmological manner, and then these problems just simply won't occur. There will be sensible classical behaviors with matter in.
Beginning with your some major thoughts about what might replace these for these radii, something for an almost beauty matrices.
Yeah. I only have one idea about that, and it's not very coherent, but I did want to say it in this forum because there are mathematicians here, and they can probably tell me it's complete nonsense. So the thing I was imagining was that you take these matrix algebras, and you're trying to take some sort of large n limit of them, so I'm going to get an algebra of operators on Hilbert space. And it seemed to me the notion of almost commuting might be something like an algebra in which all of the commutators are compact operators, or something of that type. The motivation for this was that in order to get a conventional large n limit, usually you have an interaction that's proportional to g squared times a commutator squared. You take n to infinity and g squared to zero, so that interaction term is sort of going to zero, except when you sum over the loops in the Feynman graphs, that gets promoted to some finite answer. In these theories, we quite clearly have to keep g squared fixed. G squared is identified in terms of physical parameters, even in the large n limit. So we're not going to be able to take g squared to zero, but I wanted to imagine trying to take the trace of that commutator squared to zero. So if I use the normalization where the trace on a typical von Neumann, the trace of the identity operator is 1, then the trace of compact operators vanishes. And I think it vanishes in more or less the right scaling to mimic the scaling of g squared in the usual Hatouftian limit. So it's a pure guess.
So the first statement you made is you wanted an algebra where commutators were compact.
Right.
That's, in fact, why I wrote down the algebra of pseudo-differential operators. That's exactly.
Okay.
It does have compact, but not a trace class. That's a more subtle business.
Okay.
Bracket. In special example, you'll see special examples where, in fact, the bracket of two operators will be a trace class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in fact, why I gave those examples.
Okay.
I thought that should be what you.
Okay, so that's the algebra I should be thinking about, or something like that might be.
Essentially, all the known examples are modifications of that example.
Okay, good. So I'll ask you for a reference. Thank you. Well, I really want it to have trace zero, right? I'm using a normalization where the trace of the unit matrix is 1 for large n. So compact is enough to have trace zero. And I think the scaling of, you know, when you approximate compact operators by finite dimensional ones, that the scaling that you get for the size of that term is about right. So this will be a very funny theory if it exists, because you'll define this algebra. The classical Lagrangian evaluated on this algebra will look free, okay? But the quantum mechanics might not be free, okay? So there's something like this around, it's a very sophisticated and subtle system.
I may make one more comment. Getting brackets like that, that's fine. But the whole issue mathematically is that, in fact, when the brackets are trace class, then the bracket trace of the bracket is not zero. That gives you a very interesting.
This is a different trace, right? This is the trace where the trace of the identity operator is infinity, right?
Yes.
Yeah. See, in this framework, the trace of the identity operator is the total longitudinal momentum.
So you really want to.
So I want yeah. But I certainly don't want all of the finite factor, I don't think, because it has commutators that are too big.
Well, my problem with it is that if you want to say what you mean by compact, other cases, you've got to have the trace infinite to be able to talk about parts that are compact. Otherwise, the whole algebra is compact.
Okay. We should talk about it. Okay.